Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
All right, welcome everyone to the January 2025 edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club podcast. Special thank you again to ESO and Limmer Education for making it possible for us to be here together today. I'm Rimley Crow, and today I am joined by Dr. Tony Fernandez, Jeff Rollman, and Dr. Bill Toon. I would also like to welcome our special guest panelists, Dr. Nick Simpson, Dr. Holly Drone, Michael Perlmutter, and Dr. Alex Shin. Thank you all for joining us today. As a reminder, for those of you in the audience, our article that we'll be reviewing is Feasibility and Safety of Oral Risperidone to Treat Prehospital Agitation. And this is hot off the press in prehospital emergency care. As always, our discussion will be paired with an article in EMS World called Journal Watch, and we encourage all of you to check that out. It'll be at emsworld.com under the category of education and training. Thank you, audience, for joining today. If you are here live with us, you are welcome to use the chat feature on your screen to type in any questions or comments, and we'll bring those into the discussion as we go. But we've got a lot on our plates, and I'm excited to dive in and very excited that the authors have elected to share some of their time with us. So first, I would like to give them the opportunity to introduce themselves, maybe tell us who you are, what you do, and very curious as to how you got involved with EMS research. So Dr. Simpson, I can kick it to you first, and you can pass the rest of your team for us.
Sure. So I'm Nick Simpson. I'm the Chief Medical Director here at Hennepin EMS. And I sort of fell into EMS research. It was not something that I anticipated, but I quite enjoy it. And I think it really allows a platform to share some of the good work that's happening and some of the specifics around it with the rest of the world. So that's my short intro. I'll pass it to, maybe we'll do Dr. Drone next, and then we'll bounce back to these gentlemen behind me.
Sounds good. Thank you. My name is Holly Drone. I'm an EMS pharmacist and emergency medicine pharmacist here at Hennepin Healthcare and Hennepin EMS. And just like Nick, I was brought on to the team to do various roles, and EMS research is one of the things that I have found kind of a new passion in. And it's been really rewarding. And I think it's really important to share the things that all agencies are doing, because I think we all can benefit from each other's shared practices.
And Dr. Shin?
Hey, everyone. I'm Alex Shin. I'm one of the third-year emergency medicine residents at Hennepin County Medical Center. I started EMS research a year ago or so with these guys here, and I'm hoping to continue on as a during EMS fellowship year next year as well. Happy to be here.
I'm Mike Perlmutter. I'm also one of the third-year emergency medicine residents here at Hennepin. My background's in EMS, and my interest in research kind of got kicked off from quality assurance and quality improvement, and just wanting to share with other services what we were doing to make patient care better, and just kept doing it here.
Fabulous to have you all here. Thank you again for sharing your time, not only here with us for this next hour, but it is no easy feat to write up an article like this. And so we appreciate your efforts and taking the time to share the practices and the lessons learned so that others can perhaps replicate. I'll be diving straight in. I think there's a lot of interesting pieces to the study. I'll remind the audience of the objective of this one, which is to describe the use of risperidone in treating mild agitation in the pre-hospital environment. But before we dive straight into methods and results and all of that, I'm always very curious to hear a little bit about where the idea for this project came from and what made you decide to take it on.
Yeah, I can start with that. So this is Nick Simpson again from Hennepin. And, you know, this project started after lots of discussion around the treatment of pre-hospital agitation. And, you know, we've had the way that we've always done things. And there was a lot of discussion, specifically with one of our psychiatrists who did some ride-alongs and just asked the question, and we had a discussion about could there be a better way, even some of the time? And so that discussion led to a lot of discussion around best practices in emergency medicine and emergency psychiatry. And then in our own emergency department, we started offering oral medications to treat mild agitation in patients. And we saw some success there. And I think as we saw some success there, it sort of spawned this idea of, could it possibly work in the pre-hospital space? And one of the things that I learned, which was a big surprise to me, was I was in the camp of the sort of common wisdom that either the patients pre-hospital don't need it or they're not sick enough to warrant it. And I will share that as we started the very initial pilot of just, could this even be feasible? Could we even potentially try it pre-hospital? The very first patient I offered it to accepted it and I was blown away. And then it sort of grew from there. And now it's on every ambulance. And it has, I think, been a really nice addition to our, I don't know, Holly, do you want to add anything?
No, I think you summarized it well, Nick.
I'm curious to hear, perhaps starting with you, Dr. Dern, on why this medication in particular. What are some of the advantages of this medication, perhaps? I know that there was Project Beta around some best practices for treating patients with agitation, but curious your perspective with your pharmacology background.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking. The decision around what we chose was multifaceted. We, and much like many emergency departments, in the actual emergency department, tend to use olanzapine orally disintegrated tablets more often than risperidone. The benefit to risperidone, though, is that it really doesn't have a lot of antihistamine properties. And so in patients who you don't have a medical record readily available, who you can't see drug-drug interactions, and you can't see as much past medical history, and who potentially can't share a lot of that with you in the exact moment that you're treating them, risperidone is actually a little bit of a safer option. It also has, among the antipsychotics, a very low risk of QTC prolongation. So it really made it an easy choice for us. It also, as I mentioned, comes in an orally disintegrating tablet, which we thought, in the situations in which patients are being treated, lack of water, et cetera, the disintegrating piece of it is very easy. It also has a really wide therapeutic range. And so, you know, if you give someone 4 milligrams of risperidone, it's very safe. If you need to follow it up with other sedatives or other antipsychotic agents.
And I'll also add the other thing that was made it very easy is that it's not controlled. You know, I know oral Ativan is another thing frequently used in the emergency department, but the logistics of that were just a lot. And so we really appreciated having this readily available with all the other medicines.
Makes sense. Those operational considerations are also a key piece. And thinking about, do we always have water available for an oral tablet on the ambulance? So the ODT option can often be easier in the pre-hospital setting. Now, I'm going to invite Dr. Fernandez to the stage to talk through some of the study design and the methods around this, because as we dive into the results, it's important for us to understand, first of all, where they were generated so that we can think about what's likely to generalize, what might be different, and what might we want to see in additional investigations. So Tony, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Dr. Crow. And I want to send a huge thank you again to our authors. Thank you so much for joining us. I think it's a really cool paper and I'm excited to dive in. So back to the purpose of your study really quick. Now your objective was to describe the use of risperidone oral disintegrating tablets to treat mild agitation in the pre-hospital environment. And one of the things that's really important, I think, in most studies is to make sure we're all speaking the same language, right? So when we talk about mild agitation, I'd really like to, if you can explain to our audience kind of how you define that, and coming up with definitions among a research team is not always the easiest thing. So can you talk to us about some of the conversations that went into developing that that definition?
Yeah, for sure. I'll start and then see if anybody wants to add anything. So the mild agitation, I think because, you know, one of the big benefits of this is having that therapeutic relationship, and you are now offering for a patient to take a medication, which is subtly but importantly different than administering a medication to someone. And so for that, you need to have a patient that's also invested in this therapy. And so big part of the education up front was, if you have a patient who is mildly agitated, anxious, and is redirectable, that was sort of the key word that we used with our crews, is if they are not redirectable, then this is not appropriate for them. And as I think we talk about later, patients that, you know, accept it or not, I think that's going to be an important piece, is if there's a patient that is wildly agitated, that is, you know, not able to have any discussion, that is not a patient that was appropriate to even offer it to. And so, you know, we use ESO for our charting system. And so another way that we've described it is we use the RAS, you know, the Richmond Agitation Scale. And so using that, that's more of like a plus one. And so when we counsel the medics, you know, to offer this, because this was not something that we had done before, the conversation would frequently go something like, hey, I can see that you're uncomfortable, that you're anxious. You know, if you are interested, we have this medication that we can offer to help make you, you know, feel a little bit better, to feel more relaxed, to treat that symptom that you're feeling. And then reminding both the crews and the patients that this is a symptom. This is not a, you know, condition, a diagnosis. This is just a symptom. And so while we figure out what's going on, what's causing that, we're going to try to make you feel better. I don't know if you guys have anything to add, or Dr. John.
Fantastic. I think that was well done. And I think we can all understand how you came to that definition and why that's particularly important for this medication, the administration in the pre-hospital environment. So we talked about this study was conducted in Hennepin EMS. And can you give our audience a little bit more information about Hennepin EMS, who you are, what your system is like, and the population you serve?
Yeah, I can speak to that a little bit. So Hennepin EMS is an urban suburban EMS agency, or a third service agency. We are also sort of hospital based. And so, which allows us to, you know, early on, before Holly was with us with any protected time, we were able to sort of bounce things off her. And we, as part of the hospital, you know, we have a lot of influence, I think, from our emergency medicine, which has been helpful, especially projects like this, to take, you know, the big sort of tertiary level one trauma center and see, you know, what can we translate into the pre-hospital space? And sometimes now in 2024, 25, vice versa. And so, you know, we cover a service area of 266 square miles, and we serve 14 municipalities, one of which being the majority of Minneapolis downtown. And so it's a big, busy service. We go on about 100,000 calls a year, and we transport about 65,000 patients. During the time of this paper, we were a single-tier ALS agency with two medics on every ambulance, and we now have added some BLS trucks that have two EMTs on every ambulance. So that's a growing program, but that was not around during the time of this paper. So yeah, we see sort of all variations, all socioeconomic groups, a number of different languages. You know, language services is another thing that we could talk about at length someday, but lots of different patients, very diverse patient population, lots of different cultures. And so I think it's one of the things that I really enjoy about working here at Hennepin, is we see a lot.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you for that. So again, part of the study that I thought was really interesting is you didn't just have a memo that went out or just put this medication on your trucks and just said, okay, folks, go use it. You had a service-wide education that you gave to, I think at the time it was about 165 paramedics in your agency. What went into developing that education module, and how do you think that was successful among your staff?
Yeah, so when we developed our education, some of what we did was take the high points that were applicable from the emergency medicine education that went out to our faculty, and then tried to, you know, take those high points and hone in on the practical aspects. You know, EMS were practical people. And so, you know, they care less, I think, in general about the sort of the chlorpromazine equivalents as much as the, how do we do this? What does this look like? And is this going to matter? And I think that was one of the things that, you know, it was well known that there was a small subset of patients, at least, where, you know, they wanted something for their agitation, but they didn't want a shot. And that was, you know, previously what we had to offer, was there was parenteral or nothing. And so talking through those things, with the sort of background with some very light touches on the best practices was in a video that went out ahead of time. And then there was a short discussion on more of the logistics in person as part of our sort of semi-annual education.
Always, education is always very important to a successful intervention implementation. So I think that that's great. So let's talk a little bit about how your inclusion and exclusion criteria. How did you identify the patients that you wanted to include? And how did you figure among that, how did you figure out who did you need to exclude from the analysis?
Yeah, so I'm going to do some very brief intro to that, and then I'll kick it to our abstractors behind me here, Dr. Shin and Perlmutter. So the overall thing that we started with was who had risperidone charted, because we didn't necessarily review every patient that had a RAS of plus one, but we reviewed patients that had it documented. And that made it palpable to look back and see, is, you know, with 100,000 potential charts a year, it was too much to look at everyone that was a little bit agitated. So we looked at the ones where the medics thought about it and documented that. And as far as exclusions, I'll kick it to these two behind me to say, you know, when you reviewed a chart, what kicked it out?
Yeah, I think actually it was pretty minimal. And I think we each looked at about half and then had crossover for inter-rater reliability. And I think almost all of them were included. And really the only thing that kicked them out of this analysis was missing data or charts where the medic thought about it and charted it and said, we considered risperidone, but we didn't end up giving it for one reason or another. And most often that was either the patient changed their mind or the patient spat it out. I think there were, I can't remember the exact, but a single digit number of cases where the patient changed their mind in one way or another. And that was most of where our charts were lost, but everybody else was included in the analysis. So it ended up being a very high percentage.
Yeah, and just to clarify, this was just adults, right? Any pediatrics were excluded also, is that right?
Yeah, and our adult protocol starts at age 14. So we would offer this medication to a 15-year-old, but not below that, not below a 14-year-old.
And you were able to collect a whole host of variables to include in your analysis. You had data service and the patient's age and sex and the response to scene. You collected some scene time information as well. One of the things I like to ask, particularly when you're doing a retrospective study, is were there data that you were hoping you'd be able to include that you just didn't have access to?
Gosh, I mean, at the outset, not that I can think of, aside from the follow-up piece. I mean, to me, the thing that would be the holy grail that we haven't had the bandwidth to tackle yet is if we were to look at all patients that got pre-hospital medication to treat agitation, how does this affect that overall number? And just based on the scope of this article, that wasn't something we were able to tackle. But I think that combined with during their emergency care in the emergency department, how does it, you know, if we look at total numbers, is this more, is this less, is this the same? That's the only thing that I can think of. I don't know if our abstractors were feeling.
Yeah, just follow up.
Yeah. So the ED follow-up is the one piece that just based on the scope was not included in this, but I think that might be a helpful project in the future.
Yeah, really interesting. And one of the things I thought that was great was you didn't just collect things like scene time and the time that the medication was administered, but you also collected any unexpected events, complications and the like. And I think that's going to be important as we review your results late in a minute. So let's talk about your primary outcome. And that was, correct me if I'm wrong, that was the administration of any additional medications to treat agitation. Is that right?
Yeah. And the question as we started this project out was, you know, one, would it ever be possible? And as we started to learn, it is possible. Then we wanted to make sure that we weren't doing something that was like, you know, spitting in the wind. And we wanted to make sure that we're not giving a medication to give it and then they immediately need something else. And so in other papers, it's been termed sort of a rescue medication, but that was the initial thought is, can we use it? And then does it work or do we think it works? And so yeah, that was our initial step.
No, I think that was great. And the analysis, I think, was appropriate for this paper. You use some descriptive statistic techniques to analyze your data. And you mentioned it earlier that you did do an inter-rater observed agreement. Can you talk to us about that? How much did you folks agree or disagree on the chart you were reviewing?
It was 100%.
I think we agreed quite a bit.
And I think the benefit is almost everything was objective data. You know, it was times, it was, you know, I guess the one thing maybe that would be anything subjective is adverse events. And I think they're pretty clear when they happen. So that made it easier, I think, on these guys. I think it was 10% crossover. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I don't want to hold us up anymore before we get to your really interesting results. But I will, before we move to results, I want to open it up to any of the other panelists or anyone in the audience who has method related questions.
Love it. Love it. I think Bill has one.
Dave. You arrived.
I will wait. I will wait.
You have to wait.
I love these guys. There's a lot I want to ask them.
I know, but you have a connection there, you know.
Yeah, total conflict of interest. So
yes, total.
I'll declare my conflict and
lack. It's like nepotism, you know.
Yeah, it is.
Did you measure your kappa?
Yes, we did.
I may have missed that when I was looking through this. Sorry. So
I believe it was one.
Okay.
It is one.
That's a high kappa.
Yeah, and again, it was while they were manually abstracted, they were almost all objective pieces of data, which I think really helped.
All right, so I'll declare again conflict. Mike mentored our paramedic students for decades before he went on to medical school. So I think the team is extremely familiar with pre-hospital care. And I know that there's a lot of subtlety that gets lost when people get into the space of agitation and violence and restraint and the use of chemicals. I see Casey Patrick put a note here about, you know, how does the intranasal midazolam compare to, you know, what you were trying, or is it an option? And there's a lot of subtlety in that process of enlisting the patient to be an advocate for their own care and voluntarily taking a medication that would then assist them in their agitation. Can you guide us a little bit into that world of subtlety and how the paramedics took to the concept of another medication, and how quickly does this medication work? Was it one of those things I noticed, you know, just kind of their backup medication so they can use droperidol, which may not be very commonly used in other parts of the country, and or midazolam. So can you talk a little bit about how you got there and if folks were pretty receptive?
Holly, do you want to start with this?
Do you want to talk about the receptivity piece of it? And then I'll talk about kind of kinetics and speed and things like that.
Yeah. So from the receptivity piece, I think one of the things that may have helped is before we started discussing it with the crews, I carried it on my own person for a few weeks to months to just say, you know, would it make sense? And then I tried it myself first on scenes with patients in the pre-hospital space. And when I, again, was shocked to see that it worked, I then was able to share that during those educational sessions with the crews, on top of having that emergency department experience. So I think not just this sort of theoretical idea, but having real world experience as you're doing the education probably helped. I think the other piece is having been on a number of scenes where I know that the patient wanted to feel less anxious and the crews wanted to give them something, but they didn't want a shot, or the shot was invasive enough that it caused another escalation. I know those times previously existed, and I'm sure still exist in other systems, where it was something that the crews wanted in a similar way to, you know, we have fentanyl or nothing at a time in our service. And so, you know, they want that intermediate space. You know, they want the Tylenol, ibuprofen, Toradol, something that isn't, you know, the quote, you know, the big medication, but something that will help along the way.
And then when we talk about, you know, choice of just the nuance of, you know, agitation and the onset and peak of all these medications that are options. Some things that have been mentioned here are risperidone, Haldol, droperidol, and potentially intranasal midazolam as options. You know, risperidone does have a peak onset or a peak effect of an hour, which is very long for a pre-hospital setting. But in agitation studies, it does start having effect on agitation scales within 15 minutes, which is very similar to things like Haldol and droperidol. Droperidol obviously doesn't have an oral option that's available here for us, though it is a little faster when given intramuscular on average. And then intranasal midazolam would also potentially be an option for patients, but that has an onset of about 10 minutes in most patients when used appropriately and accurately, which can be a little bit erratic. And benzodiazepines in general have their downsides too. You know, risperidone and other antipsychotics tend to have less respiratory depression. They're also a little safer when combined with other agents. And so we chose risperidone, and we've been very, very happy with the lack of adverse effects, and we've had pretty adequate results for sedation and decreasing of agitation.
We talk about this a lot. I think less midazolam for agitation makes me feel better. Almost all of our complications with hypotension, hypoxia have come from that one.
Yeah, I personally have experienced patients who also just really weren't that sedated after the midazolam. They just kept fighting in some cases. I'm curious because I really didn't expect to see this. It was a pleasure to kind of think outside the box and stop just doing the same thing over and over. The concept of that peak versus initial, you know, by the time we get patients to get in the ambulance, get to the hospital, all those time intervals add up, and being able to give somebody a tablet doesn't require us to drop the medication, et cetera. I'm just curious, you know, it feels like a new dawn when you can kind of have that next tool in your toolbox. And it didn't really cause any extra pyramidal effects, correct? I mean, we didn't, that doesn't, like Haldol and droperidol, particularly droperidol, we took it off the ambulances in the West Metro system in Minneapolis because of these black box warnings. And here we're reintroducing droperidol. Can you just guide us through no extra pyramidal and the nausea that we see was pretty minimal, kind of mitigated with some Zofran? Or,
you know, I think as we talked about before, one of the limitations of the study was a lack of follow-up data within the study. So, you know, EHR ED courses were not reviewed for this particular course or this particular study, but in general, risperidone just at one dose should have very minimal EPS effects, but it is possible, just like all of the other antipsychotics. But we did not see any in this study particularly.
Excellent. Well, I've got one kudos for the author and one more methods question before we dive into the results. So the kudos is that you all chose to share your protocol in the supplemental materials. And I think that's a great way for other systems to learn. So both the full behavioral protocol, and again, this is a specific population. We're not talking about the population that poses an immediate safety risk to themselves or others, which I think is very well described in these protocols. But wanted to thank you for making those available in the supplemental material. It's really important. And then for those who did the data abstraction, and having been a data abstractor many times myself, I know the pain. I'm curious, when you were looking at the charts, what were the most common missing data elements that made you have to exclude charts? Because I think sometimes when we're in the field documenting, we don't realize or recognize other people will use this information. It is really important.
Yeah, there were very few cases that were excluded because of missing data. If I recall correctly, usually scene time, like arrival time and departure time were not clear. I can't even remember the other ones that were.
No, it's funny. It doesn't jump out because there were so few, I think, that were incomplete for what we were looking for. I think when we created the database, part of the thought was to make it fairly big picture, right? We weren't looking at incredibly nuanced aspects of it, which makes data collection a little easier.
Absolutely. And I think that's something to give feedback and celebrate within your organization that, hey, we have all of these, and the documentation within discrete fields is really important. A lot of times when I've been working on pay management studies, for instance, I had to read 844 narratives to make sure that there weren't missing components, but having the risperidone or the medication in the drop-down menu makes it much easier to track and to study these things.
Absolutely. So,
there's my plug for future research REMLI documentation. But without further ado, go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, sorry, don't want to hold us back from the results. We're almost there, but got just a quick question about setting and context. And again, thank you so much for joining us, and really enjoyed reading your paper and the excellent work that you're doing up in Minnesota. Was wondering, as far as the setting and context, I know that there's a lot of attention on behavioral health emergencies nationally, and I imagine also in Minneapolis area, and there's many things going on at the same time as this risperidone study, I imagine. And I was wondering if there are other, if you had maybe multi-specialty, multidisciplinary teams that were also responding to kind of similar behavioral health patients at the same time, whether maybe these teams that had perhaps a paramedic and a social worker or law enforcement, did they also have capabilities to tap into this risperidone? And then also related, thanks for including that protocol, and saw that de-escalation was even before the medication step, the verbal de-escalation. Were crews or have EMS clinicians been receiving increased education on verbal de-escalation to maybe not even need risperidone potentially?
Yeah, all great questions. I'll start with, you know, there certainly has been a broader discussion of treatment of agitation. We know we just saw this most recent best practices paper with NAMSP and a number of partner agencies. And so I think that sort of background is what led to the interdisciplinary discussion within Hennepin that sort of spawned the idea originally. So that was where, you know, there were more conversations with, you know, psychiatry that hadn't historically had a lot of interface with EMS, but now wanted to get more involved and learn more. And so that was where this all started. As far as our, you know, specialized response kind of teams, we do have those in our area. We have those specifically in Minneapolis proper within the city. And then there are some other agencies around town. Now, my understanding is that at least right now, most of those are intended for the very low acuity calls. And so if things were triaged perfectly, which is, you know, would be nice, but is never totally possible, then those calls would not need, you know, medication or those sort of things. And that is still the world that we operate in, is our specialized teams have mental health professionals, but they do not have medics largely within our service area. There's some other areas in the metro that have some of those capabilities, but in our area, largely they do not. Now that may change in the near future as we have more teams for things like Dr. Drone and myself and another physician are working on some opioid sort of response type models. And so I think lots in the future, but one thing that I do hope that we can continue to expand is, as an oral medication, I would love to see consideration in the future to put this in the scope of like an EMT or another level of, you know, training that could utilize something like this when it's appropriate. Cause I think that has been a barrier historically in the past, is that if patient needs medication, they need an injection or an IV, and that is always an ALS thing in our area.
Absolutely, an important consideration for equity there for sure. And diving in, I want to get to the results here and take a look. The first figure that we'll look at is figure one, which is the inclusion of records for analysis. And one of the things that was striking to me, and perhaps this goes along with your experience, Dr. Simpson, and your small PDSA that you did carrying the medication just yourself, but what was really impressive is out of 530 times that the medication was offered, it was accepted 512 times in that shared decision-making model. That's a 97% acceptance rate. Curious your thoughts on how this compares to other medications before you added this to your toolkit, and if in that small percentage that did decline, were there any themes or have you noticed anything, a barrier that others might want to consider if they were to replicate this work?
I'll start with the first part and then I'll see if our abstractors have thoughts on the reasons people refuse. So the, you know, I think so much of the big important piece up front was the education and the appropriate patient selection. So, you know, based on the way that we obtained our data, I think in the limitations, I think we discussed too, I mean, there is the chance that it was offered and not documented. And so there's a possibility that there are some cases that were missed. And there are, I'm sure, cases where, you know, it maybe was briefly considered, but it was not felt to be appropriate. And so I think based on that, that is why the acceptance rate was so high, based on those two big things. As far as refusal reasons, do you guys want to talk about that?
In the abstraction piece, we relied heavily on the narrative portion, and oftentimes it says accepted or refused. So I don't have a good answer for why these 18 folks either refused or later spit out the medication.
I think, to your point, Dr. Crow, I think going through hundreds and hundreds of abstract or of narratives gets a little painful. But I think for this, it was actually for me kind of illustrative, because I think the cases that stand out in my mind are patients who were probably a little too far on the RAS, like they were more like a +2 or a +3, and the medics were trying to avoid using injectables, and the patient just, you know, you read the narrative and you're like, this patient is floridly psychotic and not able to engage in a meaningful way. They weren't redirectable probably. And then there were a few that spit it out, and I'm not sure why. I think some were agitated for reasons that weren't clear, and there were a couple that I remember that were also probably so psychotic that they weren't able to process what was going on. But I think otherwise, to Dr. Simpson's point, I think the medics chose really, really well.
Agreed.
And I will say too, for those that did refuse, I think even the offer of the medication that they could take as opposed to being given will potentially change the scene dynamic. Just having been a part of some of these, I think it will help sort of frame that therapeutic relationship in a different way for the patient, potentially family bystanders. And so I think it helps to show that, hey, we're trying everything we can. You know, we don't want to use restraint. We don't want to use parenteral medication if we can avoid it, if it's appropriate.
Absolutely. I think that's a power sharing dynamic, as well as you have a choice in this decision and I'm here, you know, to offer you a choice and you can take it or leave it. That's a key piece versus an injectable obviously has a very different shift in the power dynamic. I want to look at table one, though, describing the population. You mentioned, Dr. Simpson, picking out the right population for this is truly a key to the success of such a program. So perhaps you can guide us through a little bit and just in terms of what were the characteristics of the patients who were given risperidone?
Gosh, do you guys want to comment on that at all?
I think it's interesting to me that it was like a fairly even male-female split. It's a fairly younger population, although I think there were a surprise, at least to me, a surprising number of people who were older than I expected.
Yeah, the upper range of the 80s.
In the at least 70s, 80s, yeah. Something like that, which was surprising.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, to me, from the EMS perspective, the operational perspective, I think just that it didn't particularly prolong scene times, I think, is an important aspect of this, too, as people are just thinking about how to operationalize this or whether it's worth making operational. Those are the things that stood out to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is an important takeaway, too, is the split in demographics is different than what we would see if we were looking perhaps at higher level on the RAS scale. So again, important to describe this population. In terms of the dosing, perhaps we could ask Dr. Drone to comment a little bit on, it's almost a 50-50 split on who received one versus two doses, but I'm curious about determining when it's appropriate for a second dose and how long we wait and any concerns with potentially giving too much.
Sure. So the way our protocol is written is actually written as one dose as 2 to 4 milligrams. They can choose. It's not specifically written that they could do 2 and then another 2, though I suppose they could probably look at it that way. If you want to, in general, generalize it, you can think of 2 of risperidone as somewhat equal or equivalent to 5 of oral Haldol, and 4 of risperidone is equal to 10 of oral Haldol. That is loosely described in the literature. It would be appropriate if you were going to do a redosing study, or you know, a protocol that where you were would allow to redose it. I would say I'd probably wait at least 15 minutes, just given that you don't generally see kind of an agitation scale effect for 15 minutes. Though it does peak at an hour, it's extremely safe drug, and so it's pretty hard to be over sedated for an extremely long time with risperidone. Although again. Everybody is different. And so I do believe that potentially in our study, the patient that got a milligram and a patient that got 8 milligrams may have been a charting error more than anything. We stocked them in 2 milligram tablets. And so generally, I think that those are probably just misdocumentation on our part. Excuse me if there was a second part to your question that I did not answer.
That was exactly it. Okay. Perfect. And now I want to take a look at some of the primary outcomes. So table 2 does a great job at showing what were the additional medications administered after risperidone. And again, this was only 9 patients who received that additional medication. So perhaps you can comment on some of these, Dr. Simpson and team, on is this what would be expected, or was there anything surprising about these findings that you want to comment on?
Yeah, I think this is fairly expected in that the majority of medications we use to treat agitation that are parenteral, it's almost all droperidol with a very small amount of midazolam. And I think the lack of ketamine is a testament to correct patient selection, in that, you know, if a patient is, you know, if our marker for does a patient need ketamine is someone who is actively violent and or critically ill. And so, you know, those are not the patients to consider this for. And I think that is a testament to the crews doing a good job. A lot of our droperidol is 5 milligrams, but our protocol also allows up to 10 milligrams in that first dose. And again, I think leaning more towards the smaller dose of droperidol is, again, just these are patients that are not as agitated up front and therefore seem to need less down the line.
Absolutely. And then looking into another really key outcome is perhaps what's not here is injuries or assaults to the clinicians or the patients themselves. The complications that were seen were fairly low as well. So there was only 4 patients that had any complication, with those being nausea, hypoglycemia, hypoxia, and apnea. Would you like to comment on what was seen with that? One, I remember with nausea that was commented on as perhaps related to the taste of the medication, but interested in other comments.
Yeah, so I can speak initially, which is that, so I have anecdotally heard from one patient that it was too minty. And so we've heard some sort of anecdotes about the taste, and that I think may have been related to the nausea. The other ones are, we included them in the spirit of trying to be completely transparent, but based on how the medication works, I don't know that we can say they were likely related, but because they happened after the administration, they were included. The apnea responded to naloxone, the person that had a seizure disorder had a seizure, and then there was a person that was a heavy drinker that was hypoglycemic. And I don't know if Holly, do you want to speak to the sort of the mechanistic or lack of mechanistic pieces of those?
I think the most important part of all 3 or 4 of these is that they occurred very quickly after the administration of the medication, and just pharmacokinetically would be very unlikely that they had been absorbed and started acting in a way in which would even affect most receptors. And so I think that that is the most important piece. And they, risperidone in general, it does have a very slight risk of some of these, but I mean, we're talking less than 0.5% in literature.
Right. And I appreciate the conservative approach here of interest of full disclosure of these things, but reading the narrative description in the prose of the manuscript also seems that most likely not related, but good to keep an eye on just in case. And I'll flip us over to table 4, which is the last table in this, the primary impressions, going back to what is the population that this medication is likely to benefit. Dr. Susanna, would you like to comment on, in general, the types of patient categories? Do these match with dispatch, or is this truly waiting for the clinician on scene to make that clinical impression?
Yeah, so I'll start and then see if our Drs. Perlmutter should have anything to add. But so in general, you know, based on what the medication is intended for, my take on most of these is that they are, you know, while they may have a primary cardiac concern or a primary respiratory concern, there's some anxiety component that was addressed within that. And so the primary impression is taken from the EMS chart. So this is not necessarily that primary nature code from dispatch, but this is what the medic thought after they got there. And so you guys that read all of these, do you want to add to that?
I think that sums it up pretty well. I was surprised, to be honest, was a little bit surprised by the number of non, like, strictly behavioral or mental health presentations in which it was used. And then I read the narrative and thought, this is very reasonable. And it's good that this option was there.
Yeah, it reminds me of taking one of our legislators out within the last few years. They asked early on in the call, or on in the night, how many calls have a mental health component? And we said, well, all of them have a mental health component. And I think this kind of speaks to that there is, you know, it's not like the textbooks say. They don't have one thing. There are multiple things going on. And in the field, you have to, you know, simultaneously figure out what's going on and treat things at the same time.
I think that's a great point. And I'll invite the other panelists on for the last part of our discussion, but I have quite a few additional questions myself. I am interested in implications around equity, but also safety. So in particular, I'm thinking around patient populations who are unhoused. And I read an article in the New York Times not too long ago about treating psychosis with a medication, but ultimately made them very drowsy and potentially unable to protect themselves in an unhoused environment. And I'm curious about any unintended consequences of risperidone potentially in an unhoused population and your policies around transport after administering this medication.
Gotcha. So I think all but two of these patients were transported when we did the initial chart screen. And so the vast majority of these patients are transported to the hospital. As a sort of general rule, we don't make a habit of administering sort of something like naloxone medications and leaving patients. And I think the other piece of this is that if a patient is actively interested in getting help for whatever is the issue today, I think that is a patient that typically does, you know, is interested in transport. And so I think that helps here. And so all these patients went on to be observed in the emergency department, and maybe Holly can speak to the sort of time that these are no longer effective or sedating. And I think that was another piece of it, sort of like droperidol. We want it to work quickly, but also go away quickly.
Yeah, the duration of this is always something that we talk about. And I think it gets talked about with a lot of the antipsychotics. It gets talked about when someone gets droperidol and then they sleep for 24 hours in the ED. And, you know, kinetically, a lot of times this ongoing sedation that outlasts the typical patient, I think is indicative of other things going on, whether the patient is ill from another illness or if they're washing out from a substance that has been in their system. But risperidone specifically, it does have a long half-life in the literature of, you know, somewhere around a day. But like the pharmacodynamic of it, which, you know, this is the amount that actually works in the body and is sedative, is not that long by any means. In general, patients should be, I don't like to say advice is safe to discharge, but you know, many of these patients are perfectly fine after a couple of hours to leave your department. Some patients may be perfectly fine to leave your department when they arrive, if otherwise medically appropriate, and that is completely patient specific. But it is a fairly safe medication. There is no reason why another sedative or another agent, if needed, could be combined on top of this, and that would be a safe thing to do. And so, as far as not transporting after giving, we obviously don't have a lot of information in the literature around that. But 2 to 4 milligrams of risperidone in general is relatively low on the scale of things and is relatively safe.
Yeah, I think that equity piece, and again, just that therapeutic relationship, is such an important part of this. And I hope that, you know, the sort of historical paternal sort of view of public safety, this helps to sort of turn that tide a little bit as we involve the patients in their care more.
I really want to echo that thought and wondered kind of what the next steps were, because I had that same question about how does this change the dynamic with leaving patients on the scene or transporting to alternative destinations. If they do feel better and can go to a mental health facility instead of an ER. And just your thought about where the research goes from here. Shameless plug for any EMS provider that wants to participate in one of our workshops. I wonder how many people out there, how many EMS systems are giving this medication, and how important it is to understand the experience with these either alternative destinations or alternative medications to alleviate the, I'm going to sleep off the droperidol for 24 hours, like you said, in the ER, and then overcrowding or boarding in the ER. Where do we go from here?
That's a great question. I mean, as more of these sort of alternative response models pop up, I would love to see more and more collaboration, not only at the leadership level, but also, you know, in the field, in the street. And I think that's one thing that is going to continue to evolve. At least that's what I'm seeing is, you know, initially we're going to try and pick our calls appropriately. And then, you know, you'll have your lane and I'll have my lane. And I wonder how much those are going to cross over and there's going to be back and forth as time goes on.
I think one thing that is helpful to know about risperidol when you think about alternate destinations is that some of the big, bad, scary things, respiratory depression and QTC prolongation, are very minimal. And so that does make me feel a little bit more confident about potential transport to an alternate location that's not an ER.
Makes sense. Dr. Tu, and I see you've got a question.
Actually a long list like Dave Page usually would do, but
you've got 8 minutes.
I'm not going to take 8 minutes. No one wants to hear me that long. First of all, thank you. I enjoy this work and I'm excited that you have a pharmacist on your team, because that seems to be a growing thing. But even in the EMS, I'm beginning to see advertisements for organizations trying to find pharmacists with an EM background and stuff. And so that's very exciting. So two things. One is, you talked earlier on about the EPCR, and I think Remley even made some comments about the importance of filling out fields and stuff. But I think that whether you're in the field or in the hospital, the electronic patient record still is a challenging tool. And it's not as it sometimes can become very time consuming. And I think it would be wrong not to mention that I think paramedics probably, if they had a Likert scale, where the like part of the EPCR would come on their scale because of the challenge. But I think it's the same thing in the hospital, because you hear it all the time about hospital EPR EPCR system. So I think that that's the big thing. So you touched a little bit about the future. What are you going to do actually in your system now? How are you going to continue? What's going to be the continuous, not just the cycle of quality improvement on this, but research-wise? And do you see additional medicines that are given in this format that could be used? Because I know for a while when it's escaping my mind right now, the anti-emetic that also comes in a sublingual form. Yes, I'm blanking on that. I know that became used for a while, but I remember just the paramedics in our system felt it just didn't work as well as they felt IV did. And so I was just curious your thoughts on that. Really, where are you going to go with this? What do you see as the potential future in applying this into your system? And how do you think it would be for other systems?
Yeah, so we still do carry Zofran ODT as well. And again, it's just another option that is there for the medics and the patients. You know, I think as far as the future, I don't have another medication necessarily. However, one of the things that we've heard from the crews, and this sort of harkens back to the initial inception of the whole idea, was when I was talking with one of our psychiatrists, he said, you know, in emergency psychiatry departments, they will have this idea of a pill in the pocket that they carry around. And so one of the things that we've heard from our crews is that there are times when they would like to access this medication without necessarily going back to the med box. And so Dr. Drone in particular has helped. We're almost live yet. Do you want to speak about our sort of behavioral pack, Holly?
Sure. So much like our medics would carry their controlled substance on their belt. We've developed the idea of a behavioral medication pack that would be on their belt. It would have a few different options. It would have oral risperidone ODT in it. It will have droperidol in it. It will have like uncontrolled meds that they could use, that instead of having, while having a conversation with a patient, instead of having to break that conversation, go get a medication and come back, it can be a seamless transition. Much like Dr. Simpson, you know, discussed, he carried risperidone in this way almost in the beginning. And, you know, just having a little bit more of a seamless conversation to provide this. And we're offering it to all of the paramedics so they can choose to carry it. And we hope that as people have success with it, if they do, then they'll share that and it will become more common.
I think that's probably our next step.
It sounds like a good next step. And I love this PDSA approach to having a toolkit and maybe modifying as we go what goes in the toolkit.
And one last question, and I'll say my goodbye at this point also. You're going to start looking at this prospectively as you move ahead, you know, with your data related to this. So again, you build the total number of patients and their response, you know, because there's a research opportunity just for other agencies to understand the effectiveness and how well this works and how often it's used. And I love the feedback from the providers in the field. You know, I think that that's really important when they say, hey, this would really be great if I just had it right in my pocket and stuff. So I want to thank you for your work here. I really appreciate it. I appreciate you taking the time to be here with us today and answer all of our questions.
Great. Thanks for having us.
I have a couple more. I know we got just 1 or 2 minutes left, but as other agencies hear this and may think about implementing, I'm curious with regards to some of the more operational aspects in terms of the shelf life of this medication, the cost associated with it, any shortage issues, or just general operational considerations that you would want agencies to take into account.
I'll take this one. So in general, the tablets have a several year shelf life, so it's not something that needs to be rotated as quickly. And we are using it enough that we're using it about twice a day at this time. I think when we just most recently looked at the last year and kind of spot checked the volumes we're using. So we're using it in relatively regular timeframes. It is price dependent on your agency. And so that is completely dependent on what your contracts looks like and if you're associated with a health system, et cetera. Last I looked, it was less than $10 a tablet, but it is a brand name tablet at this point. Hopefully it would be generic actually in the next couple of years. It is generic because we looked at two different, in the middle of this, it changed manufacturers and changed size. So it was a little bit harder to fit in this behavioral pack that we are building. So we were able to choose which manufacturer we buy, which was within pennies of cost difference. And then it's not controlled, so no worries there. And it comes in 2 milligram tablets that are a relatively decent size to be able to manipulate and pull out of just a blister pack. So
very helpful, and takes me back to a long time ago when I did a study on packaging and how packaging is definitely not always contemplated for the pre-hospital setting. Do I have to use my teeth to open something? Terrible. But I love that comment and consideration of if you're going to make these packs, consider the manufacturer might change and so might the packaging.
Absolutely.
And with the last minute that we've got left, I want to turn it back to all of you and give you a last comment on any lessons learned or anything you would want other agencies to know who may be taking on this as well.
I'll start and then let others chime in. But I think the big thing is that you can't know who would be interested in this medication until you ask them. And I've been surprised over and over. And I think patients that, again, are redirectable and not an acute danger, if you ask them, you will be surprised at who is interested in taking something like this.
Yeah, to piggyback off that, you know, it takes 10 seconds to ask. And then if they say no, you go back to doing exactly what you were going to do anyway. And so it really is a minimal time commitment to offer something else.
Yeah, I echo that. I just speaking from my own experience as a medic, I think this is something I wished for a long time, just to have the option for the right patient. And I think to Dr. Simpson and Dr. Drone's point, just ask. I'm also continually surprised, even in the ED, the number of patients I ask And they say, sure.
Great. Yeah, I just echo everyone else's statements here. I think it overall for me, I hope agencies consider this medication and their rigs, and I think it gives some power back to the patient in these critical instances.
Well, I want to thank you all for this work, and thank you all again for undertaking the work that is getting this into the peer review space where others can learn and build off of it. I have that very unpopular task of wrapping us up, and I hope that others will reach out to these authors and ask for more information and continue to build upon this work. As a reminder for the audience, we've got the Education Research Journal Club podcast happening Friday, January 24th, and then we will be back here again for the clinical podcast next month on February 10th. I want to thank our authors one more time. Huge round of applause, kudos, all of those things. And I look forward to seeing you all next month. Thank you for listening.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at pcrfpodcast.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website, prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsors, Limmer Education, providing educational tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey, and ESO, dedicated to improving community health and safety through the power of data.